Welcome again, one and all, to the Disney Film Project podcast. Huzzah, huzzah, we are here. This here show, all about the films of the Walt Disney Company, whether it's Walt Disney Productions, Walt Disney Pictures, Walt Disney Records, maybe. I don't know. We might go there, too. Maybe even Touchstone movies, Miramax. You never know. You don't know what we're going to do, and that's part of the fun of listening. Admit it. We're going to cover it all in the hundreds and hundreds of years and episodes that we produce here, so buckle up, folks. It's going to be a bumpy ride. I'm Ryan Kilpatrick, blogger, site guy for Disney Film Project at DisneyFilmProject.com. Along with me, our usual suspects, unrivaled in their film knowledge, expertise, and generally in being all-around swell folks. Mr. Todd Perlmutter, noted film critic. You know, the New York Times turns to him when they need film expertise, as well as fabulous blogger at touringplans.com, chief technical officer at disneydrivenlife.com, and a guy who I'm looking at over Skype. I didn't have anything else. I ran out of stuff. How are you, Todd?
That's okay. I'm doing all right today. I mean, you know, little off, but good enough for the podcast. I'm ready to roll.
Miss Brianna Alessio, fabulous blogger at Adventures of Bree at adventuresofbree.blogspot.com. I believe she's the lead writer for Variety. I don't think that's true, but I'm going to say it is. Noted critic of film on Twitter, happy person, new hairdo, Giants lover. How are you, Bree?
I'm doing well. New York is finally getting warm.
There's no snow this week?
No more snow. I think we're done now. We're going into the 60s and 70s. I'm a very happy Bree.
See, I thought we were done, too. We were in the 60s and 70s, and then it got down to, like, 35 the other night.
Oh, goodness. That's horrible. How are you doing?
I'm doing wonderfully, thank you. Okay. Work is slowing down. I'm actually moving offices tomorrow, so I'm not going to the office, which is even better.
Awesome.
The key to all of this, of course, is Miss Cheryl Perlmutter, internet diva, cruise director, apparently, happiest millionaire lover, producer, editor. I believe she flies on the flying trapeze as well. I think that's the case. How it goes at Cheryl?
Not good.
So, our subject this week is a little different. I'm sure that there were some of you downloading this episode who said, Iron Man, that's not a Disney film. I am lodging a formal protest. And I believe we've actually gotten the protest. We haven't even finished recording the episode. I believe we have protests from Disney fans around the internet already.
They're standing outside.
Yeah. But we're not letting them in. We're just going to wave from the window. Listen up, people. All right, here's the deal. Disney purchased Marvel and is now the proud owner of Marvel Studios, and the first film released from Marvel Studios after that deal is Iron Man 2. But how can we, as good, conscientious film lovers, talk about Iron Man 2 if we don't talk about Iron Man, the first film? So we're going to talk about both of them if you follow that circular logic, because they are technically films released or produced by a company that is now owned by the Disney studio. Does that make sense? Did anyone follow that, or did I just confuse everyone?
Gotcha, completely.
Got it.
Perfect. All right, let's armor up, folks. See what I did there? That was kind of cool. All right, anyway. So a little background. Marvel Studios, if you remember, the Marvel comic books have kind of been ubiquitous in our pop culture for a while now. So we've had the Spider-Man films, we've had the X-Men films, we had two really bad Fantastic Four movies, we had a Daredevil movie, we had an Ang Lee angsty Hulk movie, all of which were produced by selling the rights to the Marvel characters to different studios. For Iron Man, however, the comic book company Marvel decided to create their own indie studio, and I use the word indie very loosely here. They raised a lot of cash and basically founded their own little studio to make their own movies on their own characters that they still had the rights to. So the first one was Iron Man. So this movie was, of course, based on the Marvel comic book character. It's very hard to underestimate the impact of this film. I don't know if you guys agree with that, but just from a business standpoint, the movie made a ton of cash. Yep. Marvel produced it independently, released it through Paramount, and because of that deal is more than likely why Disney ended up purchasing the studio, because of Iron Man, they were able to go on and make Iron Man 2 and the Thor movie and the Captain America movie that is coming out soon. They made the Avengers movie that will come out next year. All of those things, as well as the licensing. If you go to a Walmart or a Target and see your toy section these days, you're going to see Iron Man figures, and they have been there for the last 4 or 5 years. Trust me, my son has about 700 of them, I think. They're very, very popular with little boys. This film, Iron Man, basically catapulted Marvel into a young male, you know, licensing giant. I just actually got back from Target earlier today, where I was purchasing my copy of Tron Legacy, and there's Iron Man toys and Thor toys and obscure Marvel comic book character toys all over the place. And that was not the case about 5 or 6 years ago before Iron Man came out. So,
yeah, not when I was a kid either. I mean, you know, comic book stores were little hole-in-the-wall places that you had to travel into really seedy parts of town to get to. Now they're, like, all cool and chic.
Right. Yeah, there's comic book stores that are some of the coolest places in cities these days now. And a lot of that is due to this film. I mean, the comic book movie genre sort of got kick-started with Spider-Man back in the early 2000s, but it was Iron Man that kind of proved that, well, you can take the characters who aren't necessarily household names and make something out of them, make something cool. So this is a very important film, not just because it's a fun one, but it's very important to Disney as well.
I wanted to disagree.
No, I'm sorry.
I really think that they just took the deal because it was the best one they got. I mean, I think they were in talks with both DC and Marvel. I just don't think that because of their relationship along the lines that they've had in the past, especially Disney.
Warner Brothers already owns DC, though. They've owned them for years.
DC's owned by Warner Brothers, so they weren't for sale.
Yeah, no.
Okay.
No, okay. The Marvel thing actually came about it's a long story, but yeah.
Okay.
It's been in the works for a while, actually.
Yeah, I mean, and the movie rights were originally sold in 1990 to Universal, by the way.
Yeah, Nicolas Cage wanted to do it at one point.
Yep. And instead, he got Ghost Rider.
Hey, he's making a sequel. He's making a sequel. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, they pegged Tom Cruise at one point also.
Yep.
By the way, have we found out if there's going to be a Sorcerer's Apprentice sequel? God forbid.
Right now, Nicolas Cage sold his Rhode Island house at a loss. So right now, I don't think he's investing anything right now.
Interesting.
Okay. That's probably good news.
Don't ask me how I find out about these things. It's Twitter. That's how I find out. Nicolas Cage sold his house at a loss.
But he's making a Ghost Rider sequel, which is bad enough.
True.
That's for his new house.
Yeah, apparently, yeah. Because the first one was so successful. Okay, anyway. All right, let's talk about a movie that was successful because it did not have Nick Cage or Tom Cruise in it. Oh, wait, was that a shot? Probably. All right, let's talk about Iron Man. So I'm imagining that most of you listening to this have seen Iron Man and or Iron Man 2 because both movies were huge. They made lots and lots and lots of money worldwide.
If you haven't, go get them at Redbox. It's a dollar.
There you go.
$2 is an investment, folks.
If you haven't seen them, I highly recommend both of them. They're popcorn movies to the max. They still have a little bit of an undercurrent of some seriousness to them, but for the most part, you know, popcorn movies that you should really enjoy. Fun for the whole family, although probably not, because I had to stop the first one when I was watching it with my kids. But anyway. So Iron Man, the original, kind of follows the origin that comes from the comic books pretty closely, actually. The original origin from the comics had Tony Stark in Southeast Asia. It was released
Vietnam.
It's Vietnam, but it was released before the quote-unquote Vietnam War began.
Correct. Iron Man's first appearance was in 1963.
Right. So it's not technically the Vietnam War, but it was in Vietnam, and it's a similar sort of thing. He steps on a landmine and gets the shrapnel in his heart, similar to what happens here. He gets kidnapped by terrorists and is forced to wear an electromagnet in his chest to keep the shrapnel out of his heart. So it's the same idea, just updated for modern times. And this is pretty similar, so if you're not a comic book nerd like myself, and Mr. Perlmutter, you wouldn't understand this, but there's what's called a sliding timeline that they use a lot in Marvel Comics. So, like Todd mentioned, The original comic book Iron Man was created during the Vietnam pre-war, I guess we'll call it. But as time has gone on, all of a sudden it's like, no, it was in the Gulf War. And then, you know, recently it was, no, it was in the Iraq War. And, you know, they kind of redo the origin every time with a different setting just to keep it more contemporary. So that the idea is that basically from the beginning of the current Marvel continuity, it's been about 10 years back.
Yep. Usually all characters, both comic book worlds, do the same exact thing.
Yeah, they always slide the timeline up a little bit and say that even though these characters have been around for, you know, 40 or 50 years, all the books that have come out took place in the last 10 years.
Yeah, it's also they tend to reboot the universes. That's called retcon, which stands for retroactive continuity, where they change things.
Yes. So the film actually follows follows the origin pretty closely, where Tony gets kidnapped by terrorists. Tony Stark, who is a weapons designer, and we get a nice introduction to him in the film with the one Mr. Robert Downey Jr., who I have to say was born to play this part.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there's no doubt.
At the time when Marvel cast him, I think there was a cheer from the comic book community that went up about, you know, that could be heard from space. Because if you're not familiar with Tony Stark from the comics, he is a person who struggles with alcoholism, who's very witty, and who's somewhat of a playboy.
And Robert Downey Jr. is all three of those things.
Yes, indeed. I was about to say, remind you of anyone you know.
Exactly.
yeah, so I mean it was the perfect casting and really put him back on the map as well when he got this role.
I agree.
Thought you guys cool. were gonna disagree with that. So Robert Downey Jr. introduces Tony Stark, and we get the fun introduction of him in a flashback after he's kidnapped by the terrorists of, you know, how what he's all about and how he is a weapons designer, and he's kind of the boy wonder sort of a thing. The original Tony Stark in the comics was based on Howard Hughes, which I'm assuming most of our audience doesn't know who that is. Mm-hmm. But he was an eccentric billionaire. Who are millionaire probably in those days, and you'll be able to see him in such films as The Rocketeer, which we'll cover at some point. But he
was mentioned on a Phineas and Ferb episode. They rebuilt his paper plane, and they called the Paper Pelican. So they covered him a little bit for kids.
Yep, he built a wooden plane. And Phineas and Ferb took off on that and did a paper plane, which I think worked out very well.
Howard Hughes never had squirrels in his pants, though.
Wait a minute. We don't know that because Howard Hughes was a little weird.
And eccentric, yes.
True.
Also in Up, Charles Muntz is based on Howard Hughes as well.
That's right.
Do we know if he owned alligators?
He could have been one of the Biddles. We don't know. But Tony Stark is basically a sort of an updated Cold War version of that. Iron Man is really definitely a Cold War hero. His creation was, you know, as we said, set in Vietnam, which is part of the Cold War. But we're getting way off track talking comics and not about the movie. So I'm going to go back. But Tony Stark is captured and works with this scientist in a cave with a terrorist who want him to build him a missile. Instead, he builds a suit of armor in order to escape. And that's what's known as the Iron Man Mark I armor, the big bulky gray armor that he walks out of the place with. And his friend, the scientist, is killed helping him escape. And when he returns home, he has had a crisis of conscience from his captivity and decides that he is going to give up designing weapons and use his knowledge and his science to make the world a better place, which causes a bit of a struggle for his company, since it's a weapons designing company. That would kind of make it difficult to turn a profit if you're not going to design weapons.
Indeed.
So, that causes some problems with his partner, Obadiah Stane, played by the one and only Flynn himself, Mr. Jeff Bridges.
Woohoo! The dude!
The dude does abide in this film. it also causes stress for his long-suffering secretary, Miss Pepper Potts, who is played here by Gwyneth Paltrow. Quite wonderfully, I might add.
She really brings something to the character, because I never liked the character in comic books, but I really like the character in the movie, so.
Yeah, she's good.
Well, she brings a little, so if you, I'm assuming a lot of folks listening haven't read the comics. In the comics, she's very passive. Not anymore, which she used to be.
Right, not in modern times. That's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, but in the original Iron Man books, I mean, she's very passive and, you know, not like a Lois Lane who's out there trying to get a story or whatever. She's very much the secretary in the old Iron Man comics. Now, these days, she has her own suit of armor and she flies around saving people, so.
Wow. Go Pepper.
That's right. But Gwyneth Paltrow brings a nice, fun kind of sass to the role, which I thought fits really, really well. But between Obadiah and Pepper, they're trying to keep Stark's company together, where Tony spends all of his time in his basement building new Iron Man armor, what he calls the Iron Man Mark II. And he's doing this because he realizes that what he did in that cave was create something that could be a deterrent to the kinds of people that he was with. So in other words, if he creates Iron Man armor, he can be a deterrent to terrorists, to people who would, you know, kill other people, all those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
Which is an idea that's really explored in the second film more than anything else. You guys are very quiet this evening.
I'm letting you. Well, because if I interject, I'm just going to constantly interject with the comic book stuff. So let's get through the movie plot and then we can do all that.
But what happens is that Tony comes out of the basement for a brief moment to go to a ball, and he finds out from Obadiah that the board of directors has voted to grant an injunction keeping him from taking charge of the company. And it's not immediately revealed, although it is later on that same evening, that Obadiah is the one who filed the injunction. So he becomes the villain of the piece, if you will. That's actually a very eventful evening, because he finds that out. He dances with Pepper, and we see that there's definitely more than just a boss and secretary relationship going on there. Or at least he is thinking that he should do that. And he also finds out that his weapon from a Vanity Fair reporter, who he had a brief fling with in the first part of the film, he finds out that his weapons that he has designed are being used by the same terrorists who had kidnapped him. And he finds out from Obadiah that they had indeed sold those weapons to those folks. Not a good thing.
It pisses him off.
Yes, it does. So as soon as he figures this out, he loads up the old Iron Man armor, flies overseas, and takes out the terrorist in what has to be one of the coolest scenes in modern comic history, comic book movie history.
Yes. It's it's pretty interesting. So one of the things that he does that really is unique to the movies and not from the comic books is he has this way of landing in the movies. That is, he kind of just falls and lands like a tripod on his leg, a knee, and a fist, and then he stands up. In the comic books, he just always kind of lands and he's there, but this is very neat to the movie, and it makes the movie really cool, because he does it, like, all the time, and it looks awesome.
It does, I agree.
It's become iconic now.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's like, it's kind of like, you know, when you don't ever see, when you see Spider-Man, you know, you see him in the, you know, the swinging pose or the crouching pose, right? This has now become kind of Iron Man's pose.
Yeah. And especially in the film when it has those guitar riffs come in the background, it makes it all the more epic, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. Much of the music in both movies is AC/DC, so.
There you go.
Almost exclusively in the second film, yeah.
Yeah.
And song is Black Sabbath, right?
Yes.
Yes, it is. So after that eventful evening next morning when Iron Man takes out the terrorists, he comes back and we find out that Obadiah was the one who hired the terrorists to take him out in the first place. I believe the words were dum-dum-dum. Is that correct, Bree?
Yes, dum-dum-dum-dum.
Yeah, it's actually he sends Pepper off to figure out what's going on with the shipments to the terrorists, and he sends her to the office in what is the most tense scene in the entire movie.
Right.
Right, where Obadiah walks in, and he alludes to knowing she's doing something, but won't stop her because he really can't at that particular moment. His hands are kind of sort of tied.
Right. He can't reveal. It's a very well done scene because he can't reveal how bad he is because he doesn't know how much she knows.
Right.
But he knows she knows something.
Correct. And she's downloading contents of a file system that's, you know, a hidden. But he gives like some USB drive with some to find hidden files with the
it's
data.
A ghost drive is what they call it. Yeah.
And so she's busy downloading, and he's talking to her, and she's tense. And she, but before he walked in, she found the video that said, you know, where the terrorists have Tony Stark, and they're going, "You didn't tell us it was Tony Stark. This changes the game. You owe us a lot more money."
Right. So we get that. We get the reveal, but through Pepper. But the problem is that Tony and Obadiah are. Obadiah figures it out and goes and sabotages Tony and takes the electromagnet out of his chest, which I have to say, the whole electromagnet thing coming in and out of his chest is probably is just
it's disconcerting.
It is.
But Obadiah steals the electromagnet because he wants to make his own Iron Man suit, which he has managed to do, but he can't figure out how to get the they call it the arc reactor that Tony has put in his chest. They can't figure out how to get that to work, so he just goes ahead and takes the one out of Tony, which is kind of nasty. But fortunately, just downstairs, Tony had the original arc reactor that he had built that Pepper had saved for him after he wanted to throw it away, and he's able to, get
Tony
down.
Tony has a heart.
Yes.
Love it.
Yeah, fantastic. And he's able to get down and put that in. And then we have, of course, the climactic battle with Iron Man and Stane in his armor, where Stane gets killed because Pepper blows up the large arc reactor at Stark Industries. And then, of course, Tony, the next day, despite everyone telling him not to, reveals to the press that he is Iron Man. And that's how the movie ends, which I thought was just a fantastic ending.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, that.
But it's not the only ending to the movie.
That is correct.
Yes.
Oh, wait. You have to insert another one.
No, so do we want to get into the universe-related stuff, what's actually going on in some cases, or do we want to go through the other movie?
Yeah, I think what you're talking about is if you wait until after the credits, there is an extra scene at the end. That Mr. Perlmutter is referring to. Would you like to fill us in on that, Mr. Perlmutter?
So, this was probably one of the biggest secrets until like a week or two before the movie. And that is, by the time this movie came out, there were two universes that actually existed in Marvel Comics that were the primary universes. One is the universe that you're used to reading, which is Earth 616, and one is the Ultimates universe, which is Earth 1610. Hope I got that right. Somebody will correct.
I have no idea. I know okay. 616. I don't know the other one.
So really quick, the Earth designations come out of the Captain Britain comic books, where he was a. Captain Britain ends up being the version of Green Lantern in the Marvel universe, but it's actually multiverse protector rather than planetary protector. Sidetrack over. So really, these movies are not based on 100% on the stories from when I was growing up. Well, they're the stories from when I was growing up, but the characters are based on the Ultimate Universe characters.
Right. They're more of – they take the classic – so for those of you who are really lost, which could easily be, the Ultimate idea was about 10 years ago they decided that there's too much – background and continuity for these characters, so they took the core ideas of them and redid them, Spider-Man and the X-Men and the Avengers and all these characters, and redid them in this Ultimate Universe, just basically taking the core concept of what they are and starting over again. Like Todd referred to the reboots and the retcons and all that kind of stuff. This was basically considered just a big reboot, but it's stuck, and it's still around today, and the movies are sort of a version of doing that, because they are a little more faithful to the original comics than the Ultimate comics, but the styles and the designs and everything are much more in line with the Ultimate comics.
Correct.
So the reason that's important, Todd, is
is because in the comic books I grew up with, a character called Nick Fury was actually a white guy with an eye patch. But when they created the Ultimates universe, they decided that the coolest actor on the planet would have to be Nick Fury someday if they ever made a movie. So they literally designed the Ultimates character of Nick Fury to look exactly like Samuel L. Jackson, knowing in advance that they would cast nobody else in this role.
And since we're talking about Samuel L. Jackson, let's bring in his other reference. Mace Windu.
Oh.
That's right.
Right there.
That's right. Samuel L. Jackson. So there's a
Star Wars reference right there. Folks.
It all comes back to Star Wars.
It all comes back to Star Wars.
Todd is not lying. So there was a comic book called The Ultimates, which is basically the Ultimate Universe version of the Avengers. And in that comic book, it is Nick Fury who gathers the Avengers, and literally, what, 3-4 years before this movie came out, Todd?
Yeah, I'm not sure the actual year, but yeah, roughly.
Yeah. They drew Samuel L. Jackson into the comic book as Nick Fury. And at the end of this movie, Samuel L. Jackson, the actor, shows up playing Nick Fury.
Yes. Yes. And basically Tony's coming home the same night of the press conference, and his security system, Jarvis, which we didn't even talk about Jarvis, dude.
Oh, we will.
We will.
Oh, Jarvis is amazing.
We talked about Jarvis in a previous podcast. Jarvis is like having problems, and basically there's this guy in the shadows of Tony's penthouse there on the sea, or penthouse thingy, and he basically says, "You think you're really smart, don't you? You think you're the only superhero on the planet." You know, he goes through this whole little spiel, and he says, "Well, let me tell you something." And you know, and he goes through this whole thing. He lays into Tony about it, and that's the little after scene when he goes, "I want you to consider this," and he gives him this. He talks to him about the Avengers Initiative for the first time, but he doesn't let him read the file just yet.
In fact, he does not. So, the Avengers Initiative is probably the craziest thing anyone's ever attempted on in film, because what they've basically done is they've taken these independent movies, this Iron Man movie, the Thor movie that's coming out this year, the Captain America movie that's coming out this year, and they're going to make a movie starring all of these characters. You know, Warner Brothers has been dying to do this for years. Right? They've Yes. wanted to do a Superman movie, a Batman movie, and a Wonder Woman movie, and then make a Justice League movie with all three of them, with the same actors and everybody in the movie. They could never get a Wonder Woman movie off the ground at the same time that they had a Superman movie and a Batman movie. So they could never figure it out.
Right. In all fairness, because Wonder Woman is my alter ego, they really should attempt that.
They are.
Yeah, they're making a TV show now.
Yep.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah.
Wow.
I believe Adrian Palicki is the star of the TV show.
Yeah, don't ask me.
Yeah, I don't know. Okay.
But they've always wanted to do the movies. They even had Joss Whedon of Buffy fame, who is actually, coincidentally enough, now the director of the Avengers movie, was set up at Warner Brothers to do a Wonder Woman movie for about 2 years, but it never worked out. But really, it's amazing what they're trying to do. We'll see if the Thor movie and the Captain America movie succeed so that they will make the Avengers movie. But it all started here, in this end scene that Todd's referring to.
They've already, according to IMDb, they've already laid some credit here. And I wanted to ask questions, so I'm going to ask my questions here.
Ask your questions.
Ask away. You have the nerds that can answer them right here.
Okay, so they did show that he was in The Incredible Hulk, uncredited.
Yes, there's a scene in The Incredible Hulk where the Hulk is also an Avenger. I'm not sure.
Correct.
That's an original Avenger. And there's a scene where Dr. Bruce Banner is in a bar in somewhere where he's on the run, and Tony Stark shows up. And I forget what the exchange actually is, but it's related to all of this.
Correct. And it's the same thing. It's an after-the-credit scene.
Yes.
In The Incredible Hulk, and I believe – I can't remember because it's been a while since I've seen that movie, but I believe Nick Fury shows up as well with Tony Stark.
I think it just the Tony is sent by Nick Fury. I don't think Nick Fury's actually in it.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I'll have to check.
But it's the same idea, and the Hulk will be in the Avengers movie as well.
And then I have one more question.
Okay.
All right.
And this might be a spoiler for Iron Man 2, so if you haven't seen 2, we haven't spoiled that one yet.
In about 10 minutes we will.
10 minutes yeah, we will. So my question is, have they shown Daredevil Matthew Murdock yet? Because one of these guys that plays a different character played Matthew Murdock in a TV series. I was wondering if they're laying for the foundation for that as well.
So Daredevil is basically on, I believe 20th Century Fox has the rights to that film. And they are pursuing a remake of it.
Because he is in the Fantastic Four. So wouldn't they have rights under that?
Well, so it's complicated.
It's very complicated.
Yeah, the reason why Marvel Studios was founded is because a lot of the characters, the rights had been sold to different studios. So Sony owns the rights to Spider-Man. Fantastic Four is owned by 20th Century Fox. Daredevil's owned by 20th Century Fox. Paramount had owned the rights to the Hulk. The X-Men are owned by Fox. There's all these different studios that have the rights to the different characters, so they could never do this big Avengers movie that they wanted to do. So they founded Marvel Studios in order to create their own. Now, all the films are distributed by different people, but they founded Marvel. They're still Marvel Studios Productions, and Marvel Studios gets all the revenue except for the distribution fees.
So Daredevil is in Avengers is basically what I'm getting from you two.
No, he's
so
not.
Not even – here's a funny thing. Not even in the Ultimates universe. He's one of the few heroes who was not actually drafted into the Ultimates in the Ultimates universe.
Okay.
Daredevil is kind of his own complete and separate thing.
But he helps everybody out all the time.
But it's street level, though.
I know.
He's like not Batman, but without the Justice League.
I guess.
There you go.
I don't know.
Daredevil's a whole big complex thing. You don't want to get into it. I've got books literally. I got 4 books about this, about yay thick, which works really well on an audio show. But they're really thick full of Daredevil stuff.
Bigger than his head, everybody.
That's right. Okay, back to Iron Man. So that scene at the very end was actually not written by the same people who wrote the movie. It wasn't produced by the same people who produced the movie. The scene was actually cut later. It was written by Brian Michael Bendis, who is actually the writer of the Avengers comics. He wrote that scene and sort of introduced that into the movie universe. And that they threw it in at the last minute because they decided what they were seeing is that they had figured out from some of the testing that Iron Man was going to be a successful film. And so they threw it in to give themselves the option of going forward and doing these other movies. And they're doing it.
Very much so.
Is kind of scary considering how much they're putting up front, but it's kind of fun too.
Yeah. I think Avengers is coming out in 2012 and the third Iron Man is in 2013, right? That's how they're doing it.
No. 2012 is Avengers, 2012 is Nick Fury.
Okay, but I said Iron Man 3.
And I don't have Iron Man 3, hold on. I have to get to somebody else.
Yeah, Iron Man 3 I think is definitely coming out in 2013, with a different director.
If Pepper Potts isn't it, she's not in it.
Well, I don't think it's on IMDb yet, because they haven't even got a script yet.
Yeah.
To you Twitter folk who may be listening, if you have anything, any information you want to share with us, please just tweet us at DisFilmProject.
Bree is bored.
No, I'm just putting it out there. I'm just putting it out there.
All right.
That's right. People can fix our mistakes.
So when I talk about scenes in this movie
Before I want to answer that question, is Samuel L. Jackson, according to this, was not in The Hulk, unfortunately for you guys.
Said that already.
It was just Tony Stark.
Yep, that's Tony Stark.
All right.
I was verifying that.
Thank you for the information.
Dun dun.
Doing my job over here is research production.
But Todd, you were talking about scenes in the film.
Oh yeah, so there are some really nice things in the film. So it's important to note that first of all the armor that he is actually running around in as Iron Man when he's you know, fighting Obadiah Stane when he's in the city of Golmira, which is where the really cool scene where he just... Favorite part of that, and I'm sure it's everybody's favorite part of that whole scene, is when the tank kind of hits him and knocks him out of the sky, and he kind of stands up, looks at the tank, just puts his hand back and fires something and walks away, and then like 10 seconds later, the tank just explodes.
And it doesn't even faze him, he just keeps walking.
No, because he knows it's going to happen.
Yeah, that's the best.
But this is actually he's flying around in the red and gold armor, and that's the third suit of armor in the movie. That's important, because we kind of glossed over the silver armor for a second.
No, you're right.
Okay, and I just love the testing phases of that, where he's the initial flight test, where he shoots himself into the wall and he goes, "Oh, it didn't go so well."
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the key to this film is Robert Downey Jr.
Yes.
Without
absolutely.
Him, it's sort of like the Pirates films, right? If Johnny Depp doesn't play Captain Jack Sparrow, those films are not successful.
Absolutely.
In my mind.
Yes.
If Robert Downey Jr. is not in these movies, they're not good.
Yeah, by definition.
And I think
very true.
He there's lots of things you can read out there about how the films were made, but the rumor, the strong rumor is that John Favreau, who's the director of the film, gave Bridges and Robert Downey Jr. pretty much carte blanche to divert themselves from the script and ad lib. And I think you can tell that in the energy in those scenes, like you're talking about, Todd, with him in the lab. I think that's where his personality comes out the most.
Yeah, like when he talks to his machines, and it's amazing because he talks to them like they're his best friends, which they probably are, because you have to remember, Tony Stark graduated MIT when he was 15 years old, had 4 PhDs by the time he was 21. I think it's computers, physics, and mechanical engineering and electrical engineering are the 4 degrees, and I'm probably wrong on at least one of those. And so he is considered, in the Marvel universe, he's considered one of the 4 smartest people. It's Mr. Fantastic, Hank Pym, himself, and Dr. Doom are considered like the 4 smartest people in the entire Marvel universe.
We might as well just retitle this show the Nerd Detail Show.
I'm sorry.
No. I'm right there with you, brother.
There's a lot of...
Look at that shelf over there.
Indeed.
Yeah, again, not good for audio, but that's okay.
You know, it's a shelf full of comics.
It is.
It's very interesting because they play a lot of... So the basic story of the movie is the story of Iron Man that I grew up with. Okay, and that is where after Stan Lee... So you have to remember, Iron Man was created by Jack Kirby, Stan Lee... Don Heck, and I'm trying to remember. There's a fourth person.
Larry Lieber, who's Stan's brother.
Thank you. That's right. So, that's right, because they all make made-up names for themselves. Those aren't their real names.
That's right.
So, together they made... And for Jack Kirby basically designed the initial look of... 3 of the Iron Man suit of armor. There's actually been 8 or 9 suits of armor, I think, over the years.
Yeah, there's been more than that.
Right. Well, discounting the stealth this and the underwater that, there's still been more.
Trust me, because my son has a book. He's obsessed with Iron Man.
Okay.
So he has a book on the history of Iron Man. I think there's actually been 22 different versions of the main armor.
Oh, nice. Awesome. But the initial 3 were created by Jack Kirby because comic books, once upon a time, where story was not written first. You draw the cover, and then the writer would take the cover and draw a story about that cover. And Jack Kirby was not, at that time at Marvel, was not a story artist. He was a cover artist.
Right. What they used to do is what's called Marvel style of writing comics, is that the artist would design a character, the story person or the writer would write a brief plot, like maybe a paragraph or two of what happens in the issue, and then the artist would draw the entire thing with no dialogue or any of that information in there, and then the writer would go back and dialogue over what the artist had drawn, and right. That was how Iron Man was created. So the 4 people that we named, Jack Kirby created the character design, Stan Lee wrote the plot, Don Heck actually drew the issue, and Larry Lieber came in and scripted it.
And it was originally not in a comic book called Iron Man. He didn't get his own comic book until 1967, and he was introduced in 1963, right?
Correct. He was in Tales of Suspense.
Correct. Ooh. Sorry.
So, oh, which was common in those days. I mean, you had Captain America was in that book. You had Journey into Mystery was where Thor was introduced. Right. So all these characters were tried out in different books and then given their own.
Right. The original armor that you see in the movie that he makes when he's held captive, that was only used in the very first episode, first issue of Tales of Suspense. After that, he'd never seen again. The next thing is a suit of gold armor.
Correct. That okay. looks very similar, very bulky and
right. But it's gold instead of gray because they felt the gray was too muted in the four color world. So, which is actually three colors made into four colors. But long story.
yeah, it's the Nerd Detail Show, folks.
That's right. We're geeks, and you're just gonna have to live with it.
That's right.
So, but the idea in the movie is that they kind of sort of pay homage to the progression of the armors. Is he goes from this initial suit that gets destroyed when he escapes. So he builds the gray armor with this guy, and his name in the movie is Yinsen. Now this is very important because in terms of no matter how many times Iron Man has been retconned throughout the years, Yinsen has always been there. His actual original name was Ho Yinsen, which was when it was in the Vietnam era, and he. This character is always in there with him, always helping him build the initial suit of armor, always changing his mindset from being the warmonger into being the peacemonger.
Right.
And it's important to note that Iron Man could be – Tony Stark could be best described as a peacemonger because he's not a peaceful person, but he will do whatever it takes to achieve peace.
Right. I think that's kind of the – so we talked earlier about Iron Man being sort of the Cold War hero. Right, because the original idea is, you know, he's in the Vietnam War and he creates the Iron Man suit of armor, very similar to this as sort of a deterrent towards peace. And originally, that's kind of the way he was for a long, long time. This movie actually served to redefine him for the new generation, because the same week that the film came out, a new Iron Man comic came out, kind of not really rebooting Iron Man, but the purpose that he has in the film of using his mind and his technology to save people and, you know, work on crop rotations and things like that, that idea kind of came forth in the comics and is now sort of the status quo for Iron Man, as opposed to in the past it was always about, you know, designing the new suit of armor to stop the villains of the world, sort of a thing. So this movie has had a real effect on, you know, on the character for the long term.
Yes, absolutely agree. It's important to note that while originally not true in the comic books is the Iron Man that we have in the movies, he's actually a cyborg. There's no two ways about it. He's got a piece of machinery built into his body, and that keeps his body alive. And that's the basis requirement to be a cybernetic organism, where you're part machine, part man. Okay? It's actually, in the comic books currently, it's carried to a much larger extreme that I am not getting into on this podcast. But the original Iron Man, why they're doing the thing with the battery in the very beginning before he builds the initial arc reactor with Yinsen in the cave is because originally Iron Man only had a chest plate. He didn't have this piece of heart inside him. It was a plate that he always had to wear underneath his shirt, and that he actually didn't have his own power source. He actually had to plug it in every 24 hours. So that was one of the original things, and so that was why he has the battery on him in the beginning, because it's kind of sort of saying this is to show that we're understanding that.
Right, and progressing from that.
And progressing from that, right. Much faster, but in a good way. I think this is really good for the character, because, I mean, things like that are kind of sort of not good. I mean, even Stan Lee wasn't initially happy with the character after a few years, and that's why it shifted from being a Cold War-era communist type plot line over and over again to a terrorist oriented plot line. And that was actually done in the 70s, by right. the way, for people who don't realize that. It wasn't done for this movie. It had been done a long time ago. So some important things going on here. The other character that in the movie is called Raza, but in the original story and throughout the reboots as well, he is a character named Wong Chu. So Wong Chu works for this guy called the Mandarin. Okay, and that's where the whole Ten Rings concept comes in. And it's important because this will probably play into later movies if the movies do continue. is because the Mandarin is kind of sort of, outside of Doctor Doom, the Mandarin is the biggest enemy of Iron Man.
Right.
And each one has a different power.
Yeah, there's lots of things in this film that kind of are just little nods to the comics, which I thought was kind of cool. But I think it works even if you don't know this. I'm assuming, Bree, does it work even if you don't understand that stuff?
I think so. One thing I noticed was when they showed what was supposed to be Hugh Hefner, which was actually Stan Lee, I believe, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yes.
Right. I noticed little things throughout. I mean, I'm not big on comics like you guys apparently are, but so I don't understand many of the nods to comics, but as soon as I saw him, it was one of those moments where you point at the television and scream, "That's him!"
Right.
You know.
Yep. And Stan Lee makes a cameo in all the Marvel movies, in case you haven't noticed.
Also important is that Obadiah Stane, right? He actually is the one who, in comic books, forces Tony Stark to get drunk, takes over his business, steals it, which is what's going on in the movie. And he creates, in order to get back at Tony, he steals the Iron Man suit from him, just like in the movie, and builds what's called the Ironmonger armor, which is, you'll remember there's this conversation where they're having, that they're having just after he gets back, where he goes, "Show it to me," talking about his heart. Right. But he says something about, "We're Ironmongers, this is what we do, we make weapons."
Right.
Right? This is Stane's approach to the business, and it's not no longer Tony's approach to the business. And I think probably Tony was probably pushing there to begin with, because I can't, like you said, we found out later on that he's trying to kill, he's the one who hired the terrorists to kidnap Tony in the first place.
Right.
So that's the important thing. Yeah, we'll skip over the sticking the hand into the chest scene.
Please.
Yeah, that scene still makes me uncomfortable, even though I've seen the movie like 4 times now.
I notice, like, whenever I watch it, I have to keep fidgeting in order to make myself comfortable, and even doing that doesn't make
myself. Even that doesn't work, yeah.
No. Can we talk about the machines a little bit, or are you... I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I was getting to Jarvis and the machines anyway, so that we can go right to it.
Okay. I was just going to say, I love how in the showroom, like when you were saying, when he accidentally slammed up against the wall and says, "Oh, that wasn't supposed to happen," or whatever. I love when he talks to the little machine and says, "If you spray me one more time, I'm donating you to a community college," or he says something like that, or city college.
Yeah.
I love that. Now, that machine and Jarvis are two separate entities completely, correct?
Yeah. The background for this character in the movie is that he created the armature thing when he was much younger, and Jarvis when he was much older. But they're based on the same artificial intelligence. You could almost think of it as like Mach 1 of Jarvis and Mach whatever of Jarvis.
Okay.
They're now, both Jarvis, artificial intelligence.
Jarvis is voiced by Paul Bettany. I was actually just about to look his name up online. Do you guys know what he was in? What else he was in? Or?
I do not.
I know the name. I just can't place him.
I've heard the name, but I don't know.
Oh, well, he's in A Beautiful Mind, The Da Vinci Code, a few other things.
Was he in A Knight's Tale? Am I thinking of the right person? I think that was from...
Yes.
Old.
So you are correct.
Oh, there. I know who it is. Yay. Okay.
Yay. You did good.
Props to Paul Bettany, then. He's awesome.
Yep. And Jarvis, in the film, is a sort of a electronic housekeeper of sorts. But in the comics, he's a real-life butler, and he actually becomes the Avengers butler because Iron Man pays for the Avengers.
That's right.
Which is interesting. But I think, like we said, the film really works because of Downey adding the humor and everything to it.
Absolutely.
You know, and especially in that scene. But I don't know. I mean, we haven't talked a whole lot about the movie. We talked a lot about, you know, where it's come from and some of the things that have happened in it. But, I mean, I think the film works because it has just that perfect balance. Even though it's an origin story, and origin stories can be kind of ponderous at times, even though they're good. It works because it has enough action and enough comedy to make it to strike a good balance between
that's
the
right.
two.
And you know what else? Instead of throwing all the geeky stuff in your face all at once, they progress through it, which is really
right.
helpful. Okay, you know, like the initial arc reactor, they go through its specs, you know, but it's like a throw off. And then later on, he talks about what is it? The when he changes the alloy of the armor for the Mach 3 armor, so it doesn't freeze up, which is, you know, the whole way he wins the battle at the end. he steals it from the Seraphim tactical satellite, which is, for the geeky folks, that's the satellite where in comic books he originally captures the unicorn guy, the guy who shoots, not the unicorn, the living laser he originally captures in the Seraphim satellite, right? I think so.
I don't have that one, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Can't help you there.
I'm going. I love, you know who one of my favorite characters in the whole movie? The guy playing Agent Coulson. Agent Coulson just rocks.
And Agent Coulson is the agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., who's an agent of Nick Fury. And he kind of appears in this movie and comes through a few different times, you know, just saying, hey, we'd like to talk to Mr. Stark about his escape. And you kind of wonder what's going on with that. He does factor into the end because Pepper runs to S.H.I.E.L.D. to get help to fend off Obadiah Stane. So it's satisfying even if you don't, you know, you don't go watch the Tony and Nick Fury tag at the end. But it's kind of a fun little nod. And then, of course, he shows up again in Iron Man 2, and he's going to show up in the Thor film if you've seen the trailer. Agent Coulson's kind of our fun little tie that ties these films together.
Yeah, well,
it's a good thing he abbreviated his company name.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, S.H.I.E.L.D. stands for 100 different things every week, I think, in the comic books, but it always goes back to S.H.I.E.L.D.
No, it's been pretty. It's been consistent all along. 100 different things.
No, well, they change what S.H.I.E.L.D. stands for.
They do. They did once, right? In
comic
books.
They've done it again recently.
Oh, have they? Oh, I see.
Yes.
Oh, that's right. Because did they do that when Tony took over S.H.I.E.L.D.?
Right.
Because Tony Stark runs S.H.I.E.L.D. now, so or some or
well, no. You're like three guys behind.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Because it's Tony Stark. Then.
Then it was Norman Osborn.
Osborn.
And now it's Steve Rogers, Captain America.
That's right.
Before we move over to the next movie, there's one more person I'd like to mention, and actually two more things I'd like to mention.
Okay.
One is that Peter Billingsley of the The Christmas Story was also in this movie.
Really?
Yep.
Well, who did he play?
William Ginter Riva.
And that was
I don't remember William Ginter Riva.
Hmm.
The mystery of William Ginter Riva.
Yep, that's who he played. He looks much different now than from what we would remember him as.
Well, yeah. One would hope.
But that was interesting. And then the second thing I have is that also before this, Peter Downey Jr. was also in a Disney movie. Do we know what one that was? Anyone want to guess?
Robert Downey Jr. was in a Disney movie?
Yep, he was.
The computer wore tennis shoes.
Nope.
No. I know it wasn't that one.
Strike one.
That's awesome. It also wasn't Tropic Thunder.
No.
Oh, he's in the remake of The Shaggy Dog.
Yes. Todd cheated.
No, I did not. No, I'm kidding. Of course I did.
I like how he admitted that. Yes, of course I did. All right. Very nice.
So I thought that was cute that you know, he had been in a Disney movie, so.
That kind of shows you where his career was before this film, you know? I mean, not that wasn't a good movie, but he was not the lead in that movie.
No.
You know, he was a secondary character, so. Yep. But Iron Man revived his career, and Iron Man 2 apparently took it to new heights because he is now a very, very in-demand actor. So should we move on and discuss that film briefly? This one's probably more recent for everybody because it just came out last year. But it's very good in that it picks up right where the first film left off, which is why the first film had such a perfect ending. He reveals to the world he's Iron Man, and then the movie ends, and you can kind of draw your own conclusions from there and have your own complete story, or, you know, it's set up very well for a sequel. Which is what they decided to do, because there were piles of cash to be made.
And according to piles of cash, they changed one of the actors.
They did.
Yes, they did. We didn't even touch on this in the first film. So,
but I just noticed it when I switched movies in IMDb.
It was actually a big thing.
It was a big to-do, yeah. So Terrence Howard played Colonel James Rhodes, or Lieutenant James Rhodes. I don't remember what
Lieutenant Colonel James Rhodes.
Lieutenant Colonel. See, I got it. That's what I said. James Rhodes was played by Terrence Howard in the first film. And Rhodey has long been Tony's best friend. He was his kind of liaison between himself and between Stark and the military-industrial complex, if you will.
Yes.
And so Terrence Howard played Rhodey in the first film. And the reason why he wanted more money for the second film, if you've seen it, you probably figured it out, is... Rhodey at one point in the comics took over as Iron Man, and then eventually got his own suit of armor that was silver and gray and black and had all sorts of guns and fun stuff on it. And they called him War Machine. He actually has his own comic book right now. And so Terrence Howard, being a smart actor, Oscar-winning actor, had done his research and knew that Rhodey would get his own suit of armor and possibly his own spinoff film. And asked for more money for the second film. And
money,
Marvel,
money.
And Marvel, being an independent studio, told Terrence Howard that with his big demand of a pile of cash, that he could get to step in. And he was no longer welcome as James Rhodes, and they cast another Oscar winner, Don Cheadle, as the new James Rhodes in the second film.
Who do you like better?
Terrence Howard.
Really? See, I like Don Cheadle better.
Terrence Howard acts like Rhodey. Don Cheadle acts like Terrence Howard trying to be Rhodey.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. You're out on this one, Perlmutter.
It's all right. Yep. I like him better.
You're outnumbered.
Sticking with it.
They do a fun thing in the second film that we'll get to when they kind of playing off the actor change, which I thought was kind of cool. But the film opens with the footage from the end of the previous movie where he's revealing that he's Iron Man, and we see Mickey Rourke, who's one of the villains of this one, and his father's dying, and he's designing his own arc reactor, which is kind of sets up the whole conflict of the movie really well to me, because the whole point is that Tony is Iron Man and he's this big deterrent. Like he had set out to be in the first movie, that nobody's going to mess with the United States, or nobody's going to mess, you know, do bad stuff because Iron Man is out there keeping watch. And that only works if there's only one Iron Man, which is kind of the conflict of the film. So that's why we set up Mickey Rourke's character creating the arc reactor from the get-go. But for Disney fans... The scene that you have to love is the second scene where Iron Man does his nice landing pose that Todd referred to earlier, and he opens up the Stark Expo, which is basically the 1964 World's Fair.
Indeed.
So for those of you who aren't Disney nuts, well, first of all, why are you listening to this?
Yeah, what's wrong with
yeah. Well, wait, welcome to our show. How are you doing? call some friends, have them on, call them over, have them That's listen.
Right. And then follow up with, what's wrong with you?
Right. You should have been listening all along. No, I'm just kidding. We love our listeners. But the Stark Expo, for those of you who aren't familiar, is basically a big kind of an updated version of the 1964 World's Fair, which was a hugely important thing in Disney history.
Yes. And it's not just that, but it's he intros it and he talks about his father and about I like how he's flying down and he's getting hit by things, right? And you're not quite sure what they are. He's like flying towards something to make it seem like he's being attacked, and it's actually just fireworks from the expo.
Right. Pretty funny.
You know, he intros the thing. You know, the point is that you start to feel that Tony is out. Something's going on with Tony, because this is not really the Tony Stark that you are introduced to in the first movie. Something's a little different.
Right, he comes out very braggadocious and very, you know, like boastful and that sort of thing, which is the way he was at the beginning of the first film.
Mm-hmm.
But he had matured by the end. So you're right. You immediately, it's so good though, because you accepted it because you saw it in the first movie. You saw this side of him, and you don't really question what's going on. But they give you a hint of it because he introduces. His father, which there's a nice video of his father in front of this setup that looks just like Progress City,
yes.
Which Walt Disney introduced, which is just fantastic.
Yes.
if you guys don't know what Progress City is, it was basically Walt's vision of what Epcot was supposed to be, an actual city. You can see it on the Tomorrowland Transit Authority People Mover. Did I get the full name right? I think I did.
I still call it the Webway, so I don't know.
I hear you, sister. But you can see it. You can see the model that this Iron Man 2 model was modeled after.
What he says is so similar to what Walt says also, because he says, and I'll just buzz through it, but I did write it down.
No, of course you did.
Of course I did. everything is achievable through technology, better living, robust health, and for the first time in human history, the possibility of world peace. So from all of us here at Stark Industries, I would like to personally introduce you to the city of the future. So he literally refers to it as the city of the future.
Yeah.
Okay. Technology holds infinite possibilities for mankind and will one day rid society of all its ills. Soon technology will affect the way you live your life every day. This sounds like Spaceship Earth now, folks, right? Pay attention. Okay. No more tedious work, leaving more time for leisure activities and enjoying the sweet life. The Stark Expo, welcome. Okay. The Stark Expo, it's actually 1974, so it's 10 years after the 64 World's Fair, and it also takes place in Flushing Meadows, so it's the same.
Right.
It's probably, he probably bought the location and rebuilt it or something like that, or just infused it with money. This is my guess without actually having had any backstory on that.
You gave it a lot of more thought than I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we learn
that
Tony is 19% dead.
Pretty much, yeah. So, but we don't really know what it means, right? Because he tests his blood sort of like a diabetic tests their insulin, and it says, you know, 19%. And you kind of get the hint that that's bad, but you don't really know exactly why. And that's what I was saying about the scene is really well done, because you can sense, like you said, Todd, something's off. You know, because this is not the same Tony we saw at the end of the last film. But it's close enough that you can kind of go with it, and then you see that and you realize something's going on with him.
Right. And then he busts out and walks past Stan Lee.
Of course.
Who's playing Larry King. And he gets subpoenaed to go to before the Senate Armed Services Committee.
And Senator Stern, who's played by Gary Shandling, who I thought was kind of weird in that role, but that's okay.
He looked awkward in that role, yes.
Agreed. Yeah.
But he basically wants Tony to turn over the Iron Man armor. And there's some very colorful language in which Tony says no. but the cool part about that I mentioned earlier about when they introduced Don Cheadle is they call Lieutenant Rhodes, Lieutenant Colonel Rhodes, rather, into the Senate chamber, and you see the back of his head as he's walking in, and it's not until Tony walks up and shakes his hand that they flip the camera around and show that it's Don Cheadle instead of Terrence Howard, which yes. I thought was kind of a neat little thing. I mean, it's only if you really kind of knew that they were going to replace him that it really makes a difference, but it's a neat little trick.
Doesn't he also say, did you do something with your hair or something like that?
Yeah, he does. And I'm sure that was an ad lib, knowing how Favreau let these guys ad lib. But
yeah.
Also in the hearings, we are introduced to the smarmiest villain ever known to man, Mr. Justin Hammer, played by Sam Rockwell, who is just fabulous in this movie to me.
I think he does really good. He's just like, I mean, it's not the character from the comic books, but it's actually better than the character from the comic books.
Oh, it's way better. Because Justin Hammer in the comics, folks, is just basically another version of Tony Stark, another version of Obadiah Stane. I mean, like, the last 30, 40 years of the comics is all about these industrialists battling each other to build better suits of armor and all this kind of stuff. The Justin Hammer in this movie is so much better because he's so smarmy and trying to get along and funny. Rockwell is just funny through the whole thing. Even when he's being threatening, he's just funny.
Yes,
and that just
absolutely.
Made it way better.
I like how he, you know, there are things that you so want to be able to do that you see in movies sometimes, and when he hacks those screens in the Senate chamber, just by holding up whatever that thing in his hand was, and he kind of like sends
like
the video
iPhone
there.
Version 7.
Yeah, or whatever it was. It was cool. You kind of go, dang, I wish I could do that.
Yeah. But the whole point of the hearing is Tony shows that, you know, no one is really close to making Iron Man armor, which we know is not true because we've seen Mickey Rourke doing it at the very beginning. So there's kind of it does a really good job of establishing this ticking time bomb, which is always great in these kinds of films.
In fact, as soon as this scene's over, the next scene is literally the armor that he's been making is complete, and he kind of powers it up and burns his suit off and has this skeletal frame on him and stuff like that.
Right.
So...
But Tony, we figure out as we keep going that Tony knows that he doesn't have long to live because the Jarvis tells us that the palladium that is in the arc reactor core is poisoning him.
Right. And this is not a comic book thing, folks. Actually, palladium actually is a real life thing. How they use it here, I doubt you could make an arc reactor out of it because I'm not sure I know what an arc reactor actually is. But you can get poisoning from palladium. So this is actually like a real-life thing that they worked into the script, which is kind of neat when you think about it.
Very. But that gives us the clue that something's wrong and that Tony is going to die, basically, if he doesn't get this resolved. And about that time, Pepper comes in, and he decides that he's going to make Pepper CEO of the company. So what he's really doing – and honestly, it was only on the second time through that I figured this out. I think this was the third time I've watched this. It wasn't until the second time through that it kind of sunk in a little better that what he's doing is basically trying to get his house in order because he's going to die.
That's right. Well, that's even the Stark Expo reviving it is about he realizes he's dying and he's building a legacy.
Right.
Right. He wants to leave this thing for the people so that if he dies on, the Stark Expo would continue even though he's like a month from being dead.
Right. And promoting Pepper to CEO. So shortly after he promotes Pepper to CEO, he gets a new assistant named Natalie Rushman, played by Scarlett Johansson. And you have to figure as soon as you see Scarlett Johansson that she is not there just to play the assistant.
Yes.
Indeed.
And if you know who she actually is, you know.
Correct. If you know who she is from the comics and you hear the name Natalie Rushman, you instantly go, oh, I know who that is. So they go to Monaco. There's a fun little sparring match between Pepper and Tony because he wants Natalie as his new assistant, mainly because she's Scarlett Johansson.
He says, I want one.
Yeah. It's the famous scene from the trailer. But they go to Monaco for a race in which Tony has a car that's racing, and he's supposed to go and watch the race. But you can tell that he's wavering between this I'm going to die, I want to set my legacy up, and I want to do what I want to do because I'm a crazy playboy.
And then he tests his blood in the bathroom, and it's 53%, so he's more than half dead at this point.
Right. And he decides that he's going to drive the car instead of his race car driver. And it is, of course, at that point that he gets attacked by Mickey Rourke, who is named Ivan Vanko in the film. He's actually playing the comic book villain Whiplash. But frankly, that's kind of a lame name.
He's actually playing two villains, by the way. They actually combined two villains. Crimson Dynamo and Whiplash are combined into this.
Yeah.
So in the movie, so
his powers and everything are Whiplash, but his personality is Crimson Dynamo.
Well, the armor at the end too is definitely is the Crimson Dynamo Whiplash armor, which is actually I think what they have in the Ultimates universe.
And Mickey Rourke is like a tree, so he definitely should have gotten a stronger name than Whiplash.
Point.
They don't ever call him Whiplash in the movie, so it's okay. They don't call him Crimson Dynamo either, which is a lame name.
That yeah. too.
Yeah. Well, it was the whole Cold War thing, right?
Right.
You know, to have a red suit of armor because the communists are coming to fight Iron Man.
Yeah. And it's he's the character who's both currently Whiplash in the I think it's the Ultimates universe and in who was Crimson Dynamo was Anton Vanko, and that's actually the guy who dies in the beginning, and this is his, and Mickey Rourke is playing his son Ivan Vanko, just so everybody knows, or Ivan Vanko.
Which I have to say, Mickey Rourke wasn't a fan, not in this one.
No, the pigeon hair was like awful.
The hair, the bird. What was up with the bird?
It was his hair. I think it's where he got his hair from.
Oh my. I'm even more concerned.
Yeah, the character, I don't know, like taking a wrestler and making him a villain in a film, for me, is never really a good idea. I'm sorry.
But he's not a wrestler. Well,
no, he's an actor.
He's a former wrestler.
No.
No, he played a wrestler in a movie.
No.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Yes.
He was never. He was never a wrestler.
Really?
Yeah. He was in the movie The Wrestler, which he did a fantastic job.
Yes, but he was never actually in one of the wrestling federations that we know of.
That's disturbing.
Again, anyone wants to correct us on that? Come go. Feel free. I'll IMDb it.
I will Google put Gerald's it. Wrestling knowledge up against any of y'all.
The bottom line of the scene, though, is that Vanko is there to kill Stark. There's no question about it. This is his life's purpose at this moment, is to do anything and everything to destroy, discredit, and kill Tony Stark.
Correct.
Okay.
And he accomplishes one of those goals.
Yes.
He discredits him.
Correct. But let's just not skip over the coolest scene in the movie, which is the briefcase armor.
Yes. Which is another nod to the comics, because in the 70s, Tony Stark used to carry around a briefcase where he had the Iron Man armor in it, and he would open the briefcase and it had, you know, the little foam holder and the little gauntlets and the mask and everything in there, and he'd get dressed in his little Iron Man armor and he'd go off to fight crime and everything. This was way cooler.
Yes, way cooler. But it was, you know, it was worth the admission in the movie originally. That's
correct.
How I felt about it.
Yep. But he survives, and Mickey Rourke gets taken off to prison. But Justin Hammer breaks him out because he wants to design Iron Man armor and win a contract from the government.
Can I say something very important, though?
No. Yes,
when you're talking to your archenemy in prison, the last thing you should do is give them scientific advice to make their weapons better. I'm just saying.
That's a good point. It's a valid point. So Tony goes and visits him in prison and says, well, you could have done this or you could have done that better. Not the best thing to do.
No. It's like in Kim Possible where the first time they see Senior, and he tells them, well, what if you had spinning tops of doom and piranha in the lake, and then they come back to the lair later on, and then all these things that Ron Stoppel suggested are in the lair?
Of course.
Yeah, same exact thing.
Yeah. So Tony manages to get away and doesn't realize that Hammer has busted out Ivan Vanko, and he's having a birthday party. And it's at this point that they reference probably the most famous Iron Man storyline, which is called Demon in a Bottle, where basically Tony Stark drank himself nearly to death and lost everything he had. This is when Rhodey took over as Iron Man and Obadiah Stane stole his company and all that kind of stuff. But at the birthday party, he gets massively drunk and starts shooting off the armor in his own home, kind of like a skeet shooting almost, which is kind of scary. And Rhodey shows up under orders because of what Vanko has done and shown that there are other people with this armor out there. He's under orders to take the armor away and manages to go down into the basement, put on one of the Iron Man suits, and come up and fight Tony in his own home, which is just really, really cool.
It's important to note, too, that the party was something that he was considering not doing, and it's actually the secretary, Natalie, there, that actually convinces him to do whatever he wants to do since he's dying.
That is very true. And it's what we were saying about the race. Like, he's wavering between this leave a legacy part and do whatever I want to do part.
Yeah, you know, I like that he says, put on a fat beat that I can kick my buddies to.
Beverly Hills booty to.
Beverly Hills booty to, that's right.
There you
yes.
go.
And they play another one, Bites the Dust.
But we find out that he's really done this on purpose, right? It's sort of, he's pleasing both masters in that he wanted to have Rhodey take this stuff away because he knew that, you know, if he's going to die, that's who he wanted it in the hands of.
Right. And Rhodey would do the right thing. He trusts that in the end.
Right. So after all of this, what we get to see, is my favorite scene in the movie, which is, after this big fight, we get to see Tony recovering from his fight and his drinking by sitting inside of a giant donut, eating donuts, and having Samuel L. Jackson walk up and say, "Sir, I'm going to have to ask you to come down out of the donut."
He says, "Exit the donut," which is actually what's really great.
Yes. and it's at this point, me personally, I felt like the intervention of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Samuel L. Jackson and all of that is where this movie derailed from the first one.
Okay.
As a geek, it's really, really cool to see S.H.I.E.L.D. coming in, and we get the reveal that Natalie Rushman is in fact...
Name her as the Black Widow, though. They call her real name is Natasha Romanoff, and she's an agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yes, and in the comics, she is named the Black Widow.
Right.
I'm learning and so many things from you guys.
Not initially, though.
And then here comes my question.
Sure.
Is Hawkeye in the movie?
No.
It's okay. Not in this movie.
And I would bet that if you're going to reveal any character at the very end of the Avengers movie, I would bet it would be Hawkeye.
Okay.
Oh, Hawkeye. I thought you said Hot Guy. I was going to say, wait, there's a... Okay, never mind.
I believe Hot Guy is the name of the actor who portrays Thor in the Thor movie.
I thought it was Captain America. Okay.
Oh, okay. The rumor has it, Cheryl, that Hawkeye is in the Thor movie.
Oh, so I should double check that. Okay.
Yeah, well, it's just a rumor, so it wouldn't be credited yet.
It wouldn't be credited.
Rumor has it that he is there. So we'll see. We'll have to wait until May 6th to see if that is true. But for me, so what happens is Nick Fury shows up, Samuel L. Jackson again, and basically says to Tony Stark that, you know, I don't need to be dealing with you going around and blowing stuff up and, you know, dying from palladium and all of this kind of stuff. Like, I got other things to worry about. You need to deal with this. Which I thought was very funny, but not true to what the story had been to that point.
It's laying groundwork for things that are to come in future movies. That's what's really going on in this scene.
But it does a disservice to this one by doing that, is what
right,
I felt.
Well, because it's very long.
Yeah.
Okay, and I don't understand the whole sitting on the balcony drinking cocktails and chatting about his dad part. But at the same time, it's to set up the fact that his father's going to appear in the Captain America movie, that it's his father who helped Captain America design his shield and his outfit in the Ultimate Universe,
This is a new record, folks. We are spoiling a movie that hasn't even come out yet.
But this is the comic book. This is what it is in the Ultimate comic book, though. So I'm actually talking from the comic book because I'd like to point out that there's only two survivors of the Super Soldier Serum. One of them was Captain America, and the other one is Nick Fury in the Ultimate Universe.
Right.
Because Nick Fury.
Despite the length of the second film, it's still shorter than Fortuosity in Happiest Millionaire.
which Bree is convinced is 12 hours and 57 minutes long.
It is. I counted.
Anyway, he basically Nick Fury and Black Widow inject him, and I'm calling her Black Widow for the rest of this, by the way, just so you know.
That's what you should.
Okay. She injects a lithium dioxide in him, which is actually a real life thing, and it's actually something they use as a last resort against radiation poisoning, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
And so they dip it in, and the stuff recedes for a little bit, and they get him back to work, and they give him his father's case, okay? And he says, look, your father said that he couldn't build something. He couldn't take the arc reactor to the next level, but he was pretty convinced that you would be able to, and it's time for me to give you this. And so he gives him this thing, which is this. I love the video because it's kind of sort of the outtake version of the video that you see in the beginning, and it's a little crude and crass, so if your kids are in the room, just be prepared for that moment. When they put it up on the screen.
There's a lot of crude and crass in both of these films. This is not one I would recommend for kids under 13, probably.
Right.
That's why it's listed PG-13.
Exactly.
You know, he says things like, you know, he says things like make a nuclear reactor look like a AAA battery and on and on and on. And he says only you can solve the riddle of your heart, which is kind of sort of, you know, it's foreshadowing what comes is because he has to cure himself, okay?
Right.
And
he basically has to create some other way to power this magnet in his chest than the arc reactor in order to live. And that's what his father is getting at. Absolutely. Even though his father doesn't know, obviously, what had happened to him, his father is trying to get him to create this new energy source that you assume is some sort of renewable energy. It's never really kind of stated what it is in the film, what the new energy source is, which I thought, again, was sort of a weak point.
Right. Well, but we know what it is, but we can get to it. You want to get to it? Let's create it first, and then we'll get to it.
Well, Yeah, I mean, well, that's really the whole next part of the film, right? Yes. Is kind of intercutting between Ivan Vanko working on Hammer's drone robots and Tony working on this thing that will save himself.
And Rhodey enhancing the armor that he stole.
Right. So it's basically all three of them, you know, kind of creating their own suits of armor.
Right.
But Tony manages to, he takes the Epcot progress city diagram from Pepper's office after a very tense intermission with Pepper.
Over strawberries.
Yes. It's kind of cute because he brings her strawberries and she says, "Why did you bring me strawberries? I'm allergic to strawberries." And his response is that this is progress. I at least remembered there was a connection between you and strawberries.
Not nice. Which,
yeah, that's not going to work. But he takes the Epcot diagram or model from his dad's office, and he manages to see it for what it is, which is basically the diagram of an atom.
Right. And I love that he says, the quote that he says is he says about his father, he says, "Dead for 20 years and still taking me to school." I like that line. You know, it's just very, I think that's probably the most touching line in the entire movie, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, it's the scenes of him in the lab that I felt are really good, right? Because those are the scenes, like we talked about, that you liked in the first one. And that's where he's at his best. He's kind of improvising, and he's, you know, his personality comes out more and those sorts of things.
There are no other actors around. It's just him.
Right. And I felt like that's why the Nick Fury intermission, which I realize is there for a purpose. It's setting up future things and having the Black Widow and all that kind of stuff. But I felt like does a disservice to the second film. In that it kind of sacrifices storytelling in the second movie for the sake of future films.
Yeah, that's probably true. But I mean, this scene doesn't.
Yeah. No, and what this scene where he's creating the stuff, he creates sort of a collider to create
prismatic accelerator.
What he said. In order to make this new energy source in the shape of a triangle as opposed to a circle, which is that's the big change, folks.
Right.
They could sell more action figures with a triangle-shaped thing in his chest as opposed to a circle thing.
Well, but that actually pays moments to it pays tribute back to the comic books, right? Because there was a switch where he went from a circle to a triangle on his armor in the late 80s, I believe it was. Right. What I like is, did you catch what's written on the side of the crates that he builds the prismatic accelerator from?
No.
They come from Project Pegasus, which is the in comic books it's a energy lab that they're basically developing new energy sources. And I guess he ordered it. They must have it on the shelf that you can just order yourself a prismatic accelerator and put it together in your basement. I'm not exactly sure.
They have a catalog. I get one in my email every week.
Yeah, but I mean, Project Pegasus is a potential energy group and alternate sources in the United States. That's what it stands for.
Nice.
And yeah, well, you know, it's comic books. They'll do anything, okay? so it's just, you know, that's where it's coming from. It's just it's a comic book thing. It had a lot to do with the thing of the Fantastic Four had a lot to do with that.
Yes,
Project
he did.
Pegasus for a while. And so there you go.
But of course, this all culminates with the big three-way battle between Tony and Ivan Vanko and War Machine at the Stark Expo, which I really don't think we need to go too far into because I'm guessing most people who are listening to this have actually seen it. But it's a really cool sequence. I mean, it's a lot of fun, a lot of action, a lot of jokes, a lot of great stuff there. Little Easter eggs for those of you who are comics fans, you know.
Yeah, all starting from when they present Rhodey onward, there's tons of Easter eggs. Like, for example, he's introduced as the variable threat response battle suit. That's actually what the designation of the War Machine armor actually is in comic books.
Yep.
So, you know, they go through stuff like that. He tells him about, you know, the whole thing. They end up arresting Hammer. It's the scene with Happy and Black Widow going in, and she takes out all the guards except for the one that he spends 20 minutes fighting. Yes. That goes, "Got him!" And she turns around and they're all, like, knocked out or hanging from the ceiling or whatever. I love that. But that's one of the best moments in the movie. That's actually, to me, I actually enjoy that a little bit more than I enjoy necessarily watching them fight the drones. for the next 15 or 20 minutes.
Right.
Just watching her go down the hallway. And she's like, she's just like, you know, pure, you know, action and motion kind of thing. And it's, you know, every, she's like, she'd been there. She knew it all in her head. She knew where they were going to come from. Like, she'd memorized where the guards were going to be and the whole nine yards. And I love at the very end, though, the one guy tries to get her with mace. And she picks it up and she has it in her hand. And the other guy comes out and she just uses the mace in his face. It wasn't even her own weapon.
Yeah. My wife's comment on that scene was that I she said, I want to be her when I grow up.
Awesome.
I love it.
Which kind of scares me, to be honest with you. but yeah, and then we have the climax of this movie, again with Nick Fury, who basically tells Tony that he doesn't want him in the Avengers Initiative because he's a little too unreliable, based on Natalie Rushman's analysis. But Tony agrees to be a consultant.
Right. Well,
which
what
I wonder
like,
how long that's going to last.
What I like, though, is that it says the report actually says Tony Stark no, Iron Man yes. So they like the armor and the powers, but they don't want it being driven by Tony Stark. But they're not going to. They know they're not going to get that. So
well, which is an odd end piece when you think of the beginning of the movie. In the hearings, he says, you know, the suit and I are one. You know, you can't have the armor because the armor is me, and vice versa. So you right away get the fact that that's not going to happen. If Iron Man's there, then so is Tony. And then we get the fun scene with Gary Shandling having to eat some crow and present Rhodey and Tony with a medal. Yes. And we also get a fun tag at the end of this movie.
We do.
Because
Agent Coulson,
yeah. He disappears shortly while Tony's building his prismatic colander. And he goes to New Mexico, the land of enchantment, where we see the hammer of one Mr. Thor, who will be showing up on movie screens everywhere on May 6th. Have we promoted that movie enough? I'm not sure.
No, but you know what's great about that is they have the merchandise for it now in at the Hollywood Studios. I was playing with it the other day because I think I tweeted
about
the picture.
I saw that, yes.
The hammer is so highly detailed it looks exactly like that hammer sitting in the ground at the end of, after the credits here. You know, in the tag, it really—I mean—they did a really good job on the toy. Cheryl would never let me get it, but you know. You know what I liked was when they reboot the War Machine armor in the middle of the battle. It's very akin to that moment at the end of Tron Legacy where Tron reboots.
Yeah.
Right, because it's almost very similar. The colors are like red, and then they change to blue and again, you know, kind of thing. And same thing kind of sort of happens to Rhodey inside the suit there.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean I think. Like I said, Iron Man 2 to me is not quite as good as the first film, just because it's weighed down a little bit by the Nick Fury and S.H.I.E.L.D. intervention. I think if Tony had happened to come to the realizations by himself, it would have been a stronger film. As it is, it kind of shows... I mean, like, the way they did it is the way that it would have been done in the comics, right? You would have had Nick Fury show up or whatever, but in the film, it kind of makes the film not stand alone. To me.
Right. Well, like, he didn't really need to see the video that the film strip that came from his father, right? Nick Fury could have just put him under house arrest with Agent Coulson. He could have just gone to the office, seen and taken the diorama, and we didn't need to have all that, you know, 10 minutes of them talking that goes on.
Right. I think honestly, Nick Fury didn't have to be in the film or the Black Widow. I mean, as much as I love having them there as good character, you know, as good geeky characters, I just don't think they needed to be there.
Well, you have to remember, though, is that Black Widow was the she was in the early Iron Man comic books,
yeah,
right? I mean, she was one of the earliest characters introduced in Tales of, when he was still Tales of Suspense, I believe.
Yeah, no doubt that she has the connection and everything. I'm just saying, for this film, I didn't feel like she was necessary. You know what I mean? It felt like the old Batman and Robin syndrome, where it's like, hey, we've got an extra character we can throw in here. You know, let's put Batgirl in here. We got Alicia Silverstone for a week. Let's throw her in here.
What do you think?
It felt like the same thing.
What do you think about how they kind of change it up? Because like in the Batman movies, right, it's always the big league villains, right? But here they do Justin Hammer, who to me is not like a true villain. He's just like a bad guy, right?
Yeah.
And then you have Vanko, who is, you know, a real villain. So it kind of plays very nicely, right? I thought
right.
It's a better dynamic.
I think they did a good job of not overloading things with, you know, with villain for villain's sake or any of that kind of stuff like the Batman movies do. I just felt like they more on the other side. Like, it, I didn't even feel like it was necessary for Rhodey to become War Machine. I get it worked with the way that they set the story up, but it just seemed like they had a lot of things they wanted to get into the movie. That said, I think they pulled it off pretty well, you know. That's just my opinion. Bree's completely silent. She's like, this stupid Iron Man stuff. I don't understand this.
I'm still
I'm listening.
Well, what did you think of Iron Man 2? What were your big observations from this movie?
I really don't have any because I didn't care for it.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't like it much at all. I'm sorry.
Speaking
did
of
you
women
like
not
the first one though?
Oh, very much. Yeah. Very much.
Okay.
Now, you want it, since we're on the topic of the female opinion, did you know, back when Marvel used to solicit their readers to write in letters and they'd post them in the back of their comic books, you know, they have Marvel Bullpen and all these things, and Stan Lee would supposedly answer the letters himself and stuff like that, as would people like Steve Ditko and on like that. When a female would write in, the number one character that they would address the letters to was Iron Man or Tony Stark. So he's literally the most popular character in terms of female demographics of that time period.
Oh, interesting. Cool. Okay. Still not doing it for you, huh, Brie?
No, it's all interesting. I'm listening. I'm not falling asleep, people of the world.
I wish you guys could see her the whole show. She's like, yeah, great. Okay, good thing you guys are married. All right, moving on.
Oh, no, they're talking about comic books again.
All right, let's end Bree's torture, shall we?
Oh, stop that.
We can end Bree's torture until the next comic book movie.
Everyone's gonna think I'm some prissy little diva. I'm not. I'm listening.
You're not a no. You're not at all. It's just this movie. This is not your kind of movie.
No, it is. I love Iron Man. I'm just not big on comics. Like, I've never read any, so I don't know what you guys are talking about a lot of the time. That's all.
Oh, okay.
But I enjoy learning. I enjoy learning.
Neither do we, Bree. It's okay. We just make this stuff up as we go along.
Okay, I can deal with that too.
Okay. So Iron Man the first. You say this, you like this one, what would you give it?
Me?
Yeah, you.
Okay. The first Iron Man, I'm going to give a 4. I really, really enjoyed this. It was just, like you called it, a popcorn movie. You know, it's just so much fun to sit down and watch with the family, and a lot of fun, so 4. And I love Robert Downey Jr.
Who doesn't?
Who doesn't?
These days.
Yeah.
Now that he's cleaned himself up.
Yeah.
Todd, what about you?
For the first movie, I'm going with 3.5.
Interesting. Explain.
I know it's a very popular superhero movie. It's ranks, I think, number 5 on Box Office Mojo.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like one of the top 10. Actually, both movies are in the top 10, if I'm not mistaken.
And I think you're right.
It pays a lot of homage, you know, homage to a lot of stuff, but it's I don't know. I kind of sort of feel that it's missing. It's still missing something for me. I'm not that there's not a lot of action in it. Not that I don't enjoy it. It's just, you know, I wish they delved more into the backstory a little bit of like what's going on in the larger universe. But I know I'll get that soon enough, and I think maybe that'll make me feel happier. So,
okay. Well, I would give the first film a 4. It like you said, like Bree, like you said, it's a popcorn film. So there's not a lot of deep meaning behind it, but it's good stuff anyway. You know, it's fun to watch. There's a little bit of a little bit of depth to it. But Robert Downey Jr. really makes it. You know, he makes the film. So if you gave the first one a 4, the second one would be what, Bree?
I'm really sorry. I'm gonna have to give this one a 2. It just hurt. I'm sorry. I like Scarlett Johansson. I like Mickey Rourke, but not in those roles. So, it made me feel very uncomfortable.
Oh, wow. So,
yeah.
That's not good.
No.
Todd, sorry. What about you? Did your deeper backstory emerge in Iron Man 2?
So, like I indicated, there's a lot more, little tidbits from the Marvel Universe thrown in, but they're kind of not really strung together well, like we were discussing, like the Nick Fury stuff, right? So yeah. at the same time, the story in this movie, while interesting, doesn't flow nearly as well as the first movie does. I didn't like Iron Man 2 nearly as much as I liked the first one. I felt that while there was a lot more added in terms of the backstory and whatnot that goes on, and all the little tidbits that I was kind of sort of looking for were there, I felt that they weren't really, they were just there to be there. They weren't there for purpose of the story, right? Except for, like, the only one that I really, really liked was the Project Pegasus thing, like that I just mentioned. And I didn't, the story doesn't flow nearly as well. There's too many jumpy cuts in it.
Yeah, that's true.
It just doesn't, it's not smooth. It's not well edited, I didn't think. And so I really have to go with the 2.5.
I would not go nearly as low as you guys, even though I think I was probably harsher on it when we were talking it through. I would give it a 3.5. I do like Iron Man 2. I just feel like that I feel like it actually is going really, really well until we get to the Nick Fury part, and that kind of just bogs the whole thing down, like you were saying, Todd, and kind of introduces an unnecessary element. It's a tightrope that they have to walk, right? Because they have to set up the future films and introduce these characters, these side characters in these films, but they also need to make each film stand on its own. So it's not an easy thing to do. So we'll see how they do with the new movies, with Thor or with Captain America.
I'm harder just because I'm the Jeffrey Steingarten of this podcast. So,
wow, that's a reference. Google that one, folks.
Yeah.
All right. So that is going to do it for our look at Iron Man and Iron Man Dose. If you enjoyed our look at Iron Man and Iron Man 2, then you should go see Thor on May 6th. No, if you enjoyed Iron Man and Iron Man 2, you should go see Thor. If you enjoyed our look at Iron Man and Iron Man 2, you should tell other people about our show. You should tell them on Twitter. We are at DizFilmProject, as Bree mentioned. We also have a website, DisneyFilmProject.com, where you can go and you can read the show notes for the program. You can look over on the right-hand side there, and you can listen to the program. You can see the links to get our show off of iTunes or direct download or an RSS feed. Or if you're really nice, Todd and Cheryl will send Jasper over with a copy of it clutched in his mouth as a CD. really, really nice.
I also started making us a Facebook page.
Yes, and we have the beginnings of a Facebook page. Facebook.com. Go look us up. Disney Film Project.
Yeah, we need more people following, liking it there so that we can actually like name the page.
Really? They have a limit there, huh?
Yeah, you have to have a minimum.
Okay, so 7,000 people, please get on the Facebook page and like that. We would appreciate it. If you could do that by tomorrow, that would be great. All right, so until next week, you can keep in touch with us. I mentioned Twitter. You can also read Todd's blogs at touringplans.com. You can go to DisneyDrivenLife.com and go, wow, what technical wizardry is at work here that makes this such a wonderful website? And the answer to that would be Todd Perlmutter. That's what. Or you can go to... That's right, the wonky sluice himself. It is a sluicish job you have done, sir. You can go to Adventures of Bree at adventuresofbree.blogspot.com, and you can see what Bree's been up to. It looks like cutting her hair, so I'm sure that blog's going up any minute now. Yes, and you can see my blogs at DisneyFilmProject.com or at TouringPlans.com or movie reviews over at DisneyDrivenLife.com as well. So tell all of your friends about the show, and until next week, we will talk to you later.
Bye, guys.
Later on.
See ya.